This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right. How much time do you have?
I have some time.
Okay. You have some time. All right. So we're going to do things a little backwards today. We got right into it today, but I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to edit this. So I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to do this next part. Then I'm going to do the commercials. Then I'll do the rest of the episode. All right. So I'll have to do some crafty editing here.
Right.
But I want to play a game called Do You Remember? Okay. We're the same age. Okay. Yep. And then I want you to say yes or no. And I want you to maybe a little blurb about it if you do or do not remember it. Okay.
Okay.
Do you remember Gangster's Paradise by Coolio?
Of course.
The song. Okay. And what does that mean to you?
Not much.
Okay.
I shouldn't say that. That song. So there are certain songs when they come on, they just bring you back a little bit.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Like
yep.
That song was so freaking popular.
Exactly.
When it came out. So it's actually, Gangsta's Paradise is a great memory for me.
Okay.
I'll say that.
A great memory for you. Okay. Do you remember the first girl you ever slow danced with?
I think so.
Okay. Do you know her first name at all?
I think her name was Jenny, but I can't remember for sure if that was her.
Dude, that's definitely a late 80s, 90s name.
Right. 100%.
For sure. Jenny.
What would it be now, Jennifer?
No, let's see. I believe, what would it be?
Jen.
It would probably be like a Madison, I'm feeling like a Madison.
Oh yeah. Now a Kenzie.
Now.
Right.
A Kenzie spelled with like 14 K's or like a whole bunch of I's. Right.
Right.
Do you remember the song that you slow danced to?
No.
Okay. So I
do. Not Gangsta's Paradise.
It was. I slow dance with a girl named Kim to Red Wine by UB40. Do you remember
I hate that song so much.
Dude, I love that song, dude.
Aww.
I love that song because of the memories I had.
Well, right? Okay, that's fair.
That's fair. Yeah. Right?
Maybe like, I had a bad experience with it the first time, but that song comes on, I want to jump in front of a bus. That is not my jam.
Dude, I remember dancing with this girl named Kim and UB40 came on and this would have been seventh grade. And she told her friends that told my friends that she had a crush on me. Right. And this was like, I was like, oh, damn, Kim, the one who's getting developed. You know what I mean? And so as a seventh grader, you know, I put my hands on her hips and she puts her hands on the shoulders and we get close and we're dancing to UB40 and you know, what happens when you're starting that journey, right? I had to get away from her a little bit, right? And my arms were stretched because I didn't want her to feel it. You know what I mean? Right. That would have been embarrassing. And who knows what would have happened after that?
What a interesting way to tell your audience that you went home and took a 45-minute shower after that.
Yeah, dude. I think instead of taking a 45-minute shower, it was just like me and all my buddies with their first slow dance girls also being like, this is the closest and this is the first time a girl has ever touched me. Oh my God. Did you see that? And we were like hyping each other up because we thought that was so badass.
Right. Right. Yeah. The old seventh grade dances.
Exactly. Do you remember your first vehicle?
For sure.
Okay,
for sure.
What was it?
It was a little Chevy S10, little gray okay. Chevy S10, two-wheel drive.
Two-wheel drive? Rear wheel?
Yeah.
Right? Back wheel drive, yeah.
And it had the 4.3 liter V6 in it, so it would just cook. But it was horrible on ice or anything remotely slippery.
Yep. I also, well, it was the GMC version, which was the, was it Colorado? No, it wasn't the Colorado. The Sonoma, the GMC Sonoma, which is like the version of the S10. Right. And I also had a rear wheel drive, you know, push button four wheel drive. That wasn't my first truck, but I understand how shitty it was on ice. You know,
terrible.
did you have to put the sandbags in the back in the wintertime? Yeah.
Yeah. Which does nothing.
It just makes you spin out harder.
Right. Right. Right.
Gotcha. Okay. Did you ever get in an accident, or what made that vehicle then not drivable anymore? Or why did you get rid of it?
I have never gotten in an accident that was that bad. I've been very, very lucky.
Okay.
We rolled my buddy's car in high school. I was in a car that got smoked pretty good when I was older. But I have been, the only time that I've ever even gotten in an accident that I caused, I was going about 3 miles an hour and I was super hungover and I was picking pieces of a Quick Trip muffin off of my shirt and not paying attention at a stoplight. And I just bumped this lady in front of me, and the cop, we pulled over into this church parking lot, and the cop gave me a general speeding ticket. I was like, a general speeding ticket? I was going like 3 miles an hour. But yeah. I think he read the situation. He's like, I'm going to punish this asshole for something.
I got to do something to you.
Right.
At least she didn't like come out of the car at 3 miles an hour, like holding her neck and being like, I'm going to sue you type of scenario.
Right.
Right. My first ever vehicle was a two-wheel drive. It would have been front-wheel drive, 1987 Buick Century. And my dad should have never given me that car. So my dad, he didn't trade it in. I turned 16. He gave me that car, and he upgraded to a Chevy Blazer. And, dude, we just fucking torched that car. It was, the first thing I did when I got it was, I'm going to drive this thing as fast as it goes around every corner. And we used to just like put that car in reverse because it didn't have enough power to peel out. So the only way we could get it to peel out was to throw it in reverse, gas it reverse, slam on the brakes, and then throw it into drive. And then it would chirp the wheels. Oof. And that's the only way. And then just drive the shit out of it. And then ultimately the engine exploded, from it. And my dad was like, what happened? I'm like, I don't know. Must have just gotten old. And he knew better, right?
Of course he did.
Dude, he knew better. Jesus, man. Here's one. Do you remember your first ever deer?
Oh yeah.
I want to hear that story.
Man. My first ever deer. So Minnesota, a lot of states you could start hunting at 12, right?
Right.
Minnesota was one of them. All I wanted to do was bow hunt deer. Mm-hmm. Finally turned 12, start hunting. Don't kill a deer when I'm 12. Barely can see one. 13, barely can see one. Don't kill one. 14, barely can see one. 15, I got permission to bow hunt this farm that I still hunt to this day. I just talked to the landowner a month ago. Beautiful dairy farm in southeastern Minnesota. Lots of deer. And I started hunting in there. And I missed so many little bucks that year. like
with a bow or a gun?
Bow. I never gun hunted until I was 24, 26. So it was all bows for us. And I finally got on a property that had a lot of deer. A lot of year and a half old bucks.
Yeah.
And I could not hit them. Like could not, just total buck fever, totally fell apart. Hunted that whole season. And I was like, I want to quit deer hunting forever because this is going to kill me. Yeah. Well, we got on Christmas break and it was cold, nasty snow, whatever. And one of my buddies, bow hunted as well. And we kept seeing all these deer in this field that we knew one of our friend's parents owned and farmed. So we stopped out and asked him, yeah, go ahead. You know, it was December 27th. So we ran out to my other farm, grabbed my only tree stand I had, went back out to that farm, and I remember walking in and just seeing a bunch of deer trails and like, well, I'm going to hang a stand in that tree, and hung my stand, and I was sitting there, and a button buck came underneath me in the snow. Mm-hmm. And saw me trying to like get into position to shoot him, and he kind of ran around circled, but you know, he's a buck fawn, he's by himself, he's an idiot, and he cut across in front of me, and I just launched one, like no aiming, nothing, and it went right through the middle of his body, and he ran off, and like I remember liver-ish. Just like looking at the snow, and I could see blood.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit. Like I hit one. Like I hit one in the body. And so Tim and I went back after that, went and got my mom's car. I don't remember what it was. It was a giant boat of a car, threw a tarp in the trunk, and went out there and blood trailed that little button buck and found him. And it was like, I literally could not believe it. Like I could not believe I had finally, after almost four full seasons of deer hunting, a lot, had finally hit one and got one. It was awesome.
Oh yeah, dude. I wish, like, if I had a camera guy with me from the time I was 12 to the time that I was like, cause then I took like a little hiatus when I went to college. You know, and then even in high school, I kind of looked like I only hunted weekends during the rut type of deal. But if you would have just seen the practice that I was doing with my bow to try to shoot a deer with it, you would have just been like, buddy, you should not be a hunter right now. You should not, like, you're not allowed climbing in trees with no tree stand or safety harness, like thinking deer were just going to materialize in front of me and like taking just bomb shots at deer that I should have never been taking. Right. But I guess that's how you grow. Right.
Dude. I try to tell my kids, and like, you have no concept of how hard it was. Yeah. When I started, I mean, they are just spoon fed opportunities. And yeah, it was, you know, when we started out, like you said, I mean, I remember we had safety harnesses, but they were the one that went around your waist and it was like a seat belt material, you know?
Yeah.
And so if you fell out, you were going to die just slowly upside down.
Just going to die anyway.
I remember just crawling into like the sketchiest, you know, homemade stands and just getting so lucky of not falling, not dying.
Exactly.
You know,
I remember climbing into this ladder stand once where they didn't put in the center bar on the ladder that touched the tree.
Oh God.
So I'm climbing up it and my weight is pushing towards the tree. And eventually, in order to get up into the stand, I feel like I'm in the movie Cliffhanger having to climb out more and then stepping up over.
Yeah, dude. Dude,
so stupid.
I got into a stand one time. I was like, I don't know, 12, 13, maybe.
Yeah.
And I went out squirrel hunting in January.
Mm-hmm.
And I climbed into a permanent stand on this property that was like in a clump of trees. And so they had like nailed like a base, like you would stand on, and you kind of climbed up through that. And then there was a seat above it, but there was essentially like, you know, 2 square feet of board to put your legs on, and then a hole, like a trap door, where you climbed up through. And I was sitting, and nobody knew I was in there. My dad had no idea where I was. And I was sitting there, and I looked up straight above me, and there was a gray squirrel on a limb. And so I'm like, okay, I got to stand up and like turn around and shoot almost straight up. And I stood up and turned around, and I stepped right off that trap door and fell and like, ooh, like hit my chest on the seat. So I was like slumped over it like a crash test dummy, and my gun went clanking down. And I'm like, if I'd have fallen through that trap door, I would have landed, you know, 14, 15 feet down in like the base of a multi-trunk tree that nobody knew where I was. No cell phones, nothing.
Head down, getting wedged in there.
Of course. Like there's a 0% chance that I would have walked away from that unscathed if I'd have been able to walk at all.
Oh my God.
Stupid.
Oh man. All right. Here's one. Do you remember the day that you found out you were going to have twin girls?
Yep.
Okay.
I sure do.
What's that day like?
Well, this is a story that's wild. Okay. Wild. So when my wife and I decided to start trying to have kids, I was like, they have to be born. Like, we got to time this right. Like, I don't want it in the middle of deer season. And so doing the math, like, okay, we got to make these babies during turkey season, or make a baby, right? I was only trying for one.
Yep.
And so then I was shooting for a January birth. I'm like, that would be sweet. You know,
yep.
Get 4 months in there before turkey season, get a whole bunch of months in there before the next deer season. But the problem was, at that time, I was working for Bow Hunter. I was freelance writing for a shitload of magazines, and I was traveling like crazy. I was gone for, you know, weeks in the spring, right? And my wife was gone on a medical mission trip to the Dominican Republic for 2 weeks. So I saw her like three times total. Mm. I was in an airport in, I think I was in Fort Worth, somewhere down in Texas for an axis hunt, coming back from an axis hunt. I called her and she said, well, we got to take a test when you get home, but I'm pregnant and it's twin girls. And I go, that's bonkers. Like, you don't even know you're pregnant yet. And she's like, I do. And I know what it is. And so we go home. Wow. She's pregnant. It gets way weirder. We go home. She's pregnant, but we don't know this is twins yet. We don't know for sure that this is two girls, whatever. So that appointment, however long they are, when you can finally see what they are, mm-hmm. I was in North Dakota, spotting and stalking mule deer and antelope with my buddies for a September 1 opener or whatever, Labor Day weekend opener. So I had to climb up the peak behind camp to call to get reception, because she had gone to that appointment. And she said, it's twin girls. Like, and I was like, how the fuck did you know that? Right? Like, how?
Yeah.
Well, what's crazier is, so this was 2012, 2011, 2012, something right there. My wife did a internship down in Jacksonville, Florida, when she got out of college. So you're talking like 2003, 2004 time frame, somewhere around there. Yep. And since she was living by the beach, one of her friends flew down and, you know, had to go hang out on the beach and drink margaritas, whatever. So they went to a bar and they were seated outside and they were drinking margaritas. And this woman walked by their table, stopped and turned around and came back and tapped my wife on the hand. And she said, I see twins in your future. And at this point, my wife is, you know, 24 or whatever.
Yeah.
Not even my wife then, just my girlfriend.
Yeah.
And my wife's like, who are you? What are you talking about? And she said, I'm a psychic. I have a booth down the way. You should come visit me, but I see twins in your future. And my wife's like, no thanks. Not my jam. Whatever.
Yeah.
And then fast forward to 8 years down the road that she's pregnant with twins, and she knew it instantly. And she knew that they were girls.
Dude, that's bananas, man.
Right.
That's right. Bananas. And so my wife has a friend who is, I call her, like, she's a crystal lady, right? Mm-hmm. She's got the crystals. She does the tarot card readings. She does these readings, right? And she will call you certain things. Like, she's like, my wife is a fire fairy, and that means something. And I am like, I'm like this. I think it was like a power ogre or something like that. And that means, like, I hear the word ogre and I'm just like, ugly piece of shit. That's what I think that I am, but it has like different meanings and stuff. And she will sit down and like look at you and do these readings about where you're at in your life and what are some things that are coming. And some of the things that she has said, like, or just like, they, when they happen, you're like, no way, this has got to be coincidence, right? I went through a period of time where I was having a lot of dreams about owls, Tony, like lots of dreams about owls. And she's like, Oh, okay. So she did some research on what owls means in dreams, and then she put that together knowing about me, and she started to talk about how I was going to, like, my business was going to be impacted and how my kids were going to go through a struggle and then come out of it. And it's just like all of those things happened. And I'm like, what is going on here? Like, what does, how do all of these things in the universe connect? And how does one person take a shot in the dark? Maybe it's a shot in the dark. Maybe they are literally that in tune with the universe where they can just be like, you're having twins in 8 years. Like, it blows my mind, dude.
Me too. And we have a crystal woman in our family too.
Yep.
Who, I have a lot of fun talking to her. I don't know what any of that is. And I think I started a book last night about consciousness because I'm very interested in consciousness right now.
Yeah.
Like it's becoming like a legit field to study. Mm-hmm. And particularly like in animals and not just us, but like how conscious is a deer? Like what are they thinking? Like octopus, like what are they actually thinking of and what are they capable of? And I think that there's something to people being tuned into something that mostly we can't access, you know, and you think about like kids and you look at, you know, the past life remembrance thing with lots of kids where they can remember details of being a fighter pilot in World War II and the name of the dog and the color of the car and all that shit. Mm-hmm. And then they lose it. They all just lose it at like 6-7 years old. And you're like, okay, well, was their antenna tuned to something that it just shuts off at a certain point or you're just not capable of it? And I think there's so much to that shit that we just can't even, we don't understand at all.
Yeah. So this is funny you bring this up because back in 1997, there's a band called Incubus and they came out with their very first album called Science. Okay. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but in one of their songs, they have this voiceover of this guy talking about consciousness and what consciousness is and what reality is. Right. And so like consciousness and reality are kind of, connected in certain ways. And he's like, what you can feel, touch, taste, and see is only like 1/5 of what reality is and what consciousness is. And the rest of it, you cannot explain, you cannot see, you cannot feel it or taste it, but it's there and it drives like life. And so I every once in a while I'll play that song and I'm just like my mind gets blown just a little bit because it's a voiceover from a scientist who's talking about these things. And
I wonder if it was Alan Watts or Terrence McKenna, maybe.
It could have been. I'll have to find that out and let you know. But it's like when I was listening to this, of course, I was probably on, you know, marijuana when I was listening to that. And I was like, holy shit, this guy, this is it. Like, this is telling me everything I need to know. This album, it connects with me or some shit like that when I was in college or whatever. But yeah, there's that.
There is that.
There's that. I don't know what else to say about that. Go listen to that Incubus Science album again today. Let me know what you think. Or not. You know, or not. Okay. Well,
I really don't like Incubus. I don't know why.
Okay. Well,
so much music from that time frame and I could never get into Incubus. You know what else is a weird take that I have on music?
Okay. Let's hear it.
So I see a lot of the age we're at. So you're seeing a lot of this shit circle back, right? Like this pop culture stuff, like Malcolm in the Middle and Scrubs and all these shows are coming getting a reboot, right? Because all of the people who watch them and have like a connection to them from their youth. Now we're in charge of music or, you know, movie studios and whatever. So you're seeing like all this stuff come back around. So I'm seeing a lot of stuff on like the grunge scene, right? When Pearl Jam and Nirvana and Soundgarden and all these, you know, that whole thing happened.
Yeah.
I love Soundgarden, but I don't even consider them in the same world as Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains. And it's like a very unpopular take. And I don't know why. Cause like if a Soundgarden song comes on, I will listen to it every time. Mm-hmm. No problem. But I like never seek them out, and I just don't like them nearly as much as all those other bands. And I feel like I'm sort of an outlier there.
Yeah, this is weird that you brought up Alice in Chains. I think this is a band that I listen to not a lot. I don't listen to Alice in Chains a lot. They're not even my favorite band, but I think they are one of the best bands that has, like, I don't know, like the lyrics and some of the music that they've put together. I just, like, the older I get, I'm just like, dude, Alice in Chains was legit, dude.
Big time. I love Alice in Chains.
What's your favorite Alice in Chains song?
Down in a Hole.
Nutshell.
Down in a Hole is probably in my top five all-time songs.
All-time songs. I like that.
Nutshell. You said Nutshell?
Nutshell, dude.
Pretty hard to beat that.
That song, no matter, that is a song where it comes on, I tell everybody in the room to shut up.
Right. Dude, that whole Jar of Flies EP was freaking awesome.
It was badass, dude. And that's a song, like, I would listen to Metallica Black Album before football games to get fired up. Mm-hmm. But before that album, it was like Alice in Chains.
Right.
Or something like that to get me fired up for the getting fired up.
Dude, that Metallica Black Album was, mm-hmm. I mean, that like took over the world.
The world. Yeah.
And then it was so like, good though.
Yeah. These guys have four albums out already. And then you go back and you listen to their other four albums and you're like, dude, these guys are like, dude.
Crazy.
Justice for All is probably my favorite Metallica album.
So good.
So good.
I had that on tape.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your, okay. Do you remember your first ever cassette tape that you bought with your own money?
Man.
Summer is officially here. And you know what that means? Long late nights by the grill, weekends at the lake, and hitting the golf course with your buddies. And nothing elevates those perfect summer moments quite like a premium cigar. Whether you're pairing a rich Murado with a cold bourbon after a backyard barbecue or enjoying a smooth smoke on the porch at sunset, Thompson Cigar has you covered. They've been America's humidor since 1915, offering the absolute best selection and prices. Because they have one of the largest humidors in the country, your cigars are guaranteed fresh and delivered straight to your door. If you want to try something new, check out their unique 5-pack fever deals or their value clubs for unbeatable savings and expert curation. Use my code NFC at checkout for up to 20% off your orders of $75 or more. Or visit thompsoncigar.com/NFC and the discount will be automatically applied. Some exclusions may apply.
I can't say for sure which one I bought with my own money, but I do remember getting Alice in Chains Dirt on tape.
Okay.
Pearl Jam's 10.
Yep.
I don't remember which one was my first with my own money though.
Yeah. So, well, they had a record store in my town that was like half of a gas station. It was called Charles and Charles, and it was two dudes named Charles that owned a gas station. And, then in the other side of it, they had a CD store and cassette tapes. Well, I got paper route money and I went in there, and this is legit my first purchase with my own money. I bought Tone Loc, Loked After Dark. That was one of them. I bought Poison, Look What the Cat Drug In. And then I bought, a BB King's Greatest Hits album.
Whoa.
Cause my dad.
Quite a range, dude, there, buddy.
I love blues music, dude.
Yeah.
Blues music is legit. And me so too. those were my first purchases. And I'm a little bit embarrassed by the Poison because that band was not good.
Dude. I wouldn't be embarrassed by that. That they were so freaking popular for a while.
Oh yeah. 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 And I remember it was just like, then you have like the stage of like the Motley Crue Poison era, rock and roll, where they were just kind of attractive, and that's what got them all these deals. And then you go to the, like, I can remember my aunt going to, I think it was a Motley Crue concert, back in the day. And she was telling me, like, dude, it was, the music was awesome, but they were not very good at singing. And so it was, right, just like, it was just nuts. So
yeah, that hair metal thing.
Yeah.
That, to me, for me, that did not age well. I'm not, no. I don't, did, but that shit created the vacuum in which grunge came in.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. And that let Pearl Jam become a thing. Right. And I will say that Pearl Jam in the crew that I hung out with in high school was probably played more than any album ever, yeah, that we ever listened to.
Right.
In high school. So
did you ever see him live?
Never saw him live. Nope. Never saw Pearl Jam live. Nope. I've seen Tool live. I've seen Incubus live. I've seen Deftones live. I've seen Tool live twice. I've seen Incubus, Puddle of Mud, this heavy metal band called Sparta. They opened up for Deftones, and then Incubus and then some other, like, kind of really weird bands at state fairs and county fairs and, right, like back room type amphitheaters and stuff like that. So,
man, I've been listening to a lot of Deftones lately.
Yeah, Deftones are legit. Right. My favorite band of all time, though, is the Black Keys. And I saw them live, which would probably be one of the greatest days of my life. Outside of my kids being born, dude, that was awesome. That was a great day. I've heard
they put on a hell of a show.
Oh, dude, it was so good. And it was in a ballroom in Des Moines, Iowa, where the air conditioner was out in it. So they had to hose down the crowd because people were just like dropping.
Right.
Right. So they brought a hose in. They were hosing and those guys just did not stop. And they were going and rocking the place. And people were like having to come outside in like 80 degree weather just to, like, at night, and just like to calm down and like come back in and like jump around and mosh and crowd surf. And dude, it was just like one of those days I will never forget.
What's the weirdest concert you've been to? Like, which one? So out of all those bands you just listed, have you ever been to like a country show?
Have I been to a country show? No, not in the sense that you're thinking, right? I've been to like some state fair. I've been to Willie Nelson. I take that back. I've seen Willie Nelson. The dude he pulled his tour bus out. He got on the stage. He played for 45 straight minutes with no breaks, got back on the bus and left town. Okay.
No time for bullshit for him.
Nope. The weirdest, I'm going to say weirdest one because I was just not like, it wasn't my time, was Chuck Berry at the Iowa State Fair. And he did the whole dancing around, like the guitar stomp foot thingy that he did. I sat next to an Elvis impersonator that was whacked out of his mind on drugs at that concert, to the point where my dad like switched me seats so that my dad was closer to this guy than I was. That was a fun experience.
Yikes.
But other than that, you know, I've seen a couple up in Madison, Wisconsin. They always would get, when my buddy lived up there, they would always get some like really strange, acts come through there, like techno house music, like really weird stuff that we would just kind of pop into every once in a while. And,
right.
But outside of that, just your normal bands.
Madison, that's where I saw Tool.
Yeah. At the dome there, or at the basketball arena.
I don't remember what it was.
Yeah.
It was insane.
Yeah. Dude, the Tool concert that I went to, they had two naked people, one man, one woman, spray painted silver, hang upside down and swing back and forth the entire time. The lead singer was also spray painted silver, wearing a Speedo, and he hid behind a speaker the entire time. He was not out front. He just was singing like a little hermit behind the speakers doing some really weird shit. But that's Tool, right?
Yep. There were naked contortionists hanging from the ceiling when I saw them too.
Yeah. It was probably around the same time if I had to guess.
Right.
So Yep. The old glory days, they're all over. They're all over, Tony. There's no more glory days left in us.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you one more question. And I, this is a hypothetical, and then we're going to shut it down. If you have you had a vasectomy?
No.
Okay. What would happen if your wife told you she was pregnant today? What would go through your mind?
Well, my wife had a hysterectomy, so I would be like,
The return of the Lord.
There's some big surprises here on... I don't know what I would... I would be dumbfounded. If I were in England, okay. I'd be gobsmacked. I don't know what I'd be, but it would be something.
Oh, man.
I would also be... not feeling great.
Not feeling great about it. Yep.
I wouldn't be like, this is a miracle. This is exciting. I'd be like, oh boy.
Oh, here we go.
This is rough.
Yeah. How do you like, I wonder how certain people celebrate that where, so, I know a guy who had three kids, had a vasectomy, 13 years later, had another kid and had a baby. 13 years after his vasectomy, and it's his, dude, like, looks just like him. Like, you know, holy shit, how could this happen? It's not like I had a vasectomy. Are you out stepping around on me? You know, like,
right.
It's legit his kid. And, he was just like, he said, I felt like all my body parts were removed from me at one time. So that's like, imagine being that kid and then hearing your dad say that about the announcement of your birth. Just like, yeah, I just felt like you ruined my life.
Right. Rough shit. Oh, that'd be rough.
That'd be rough. I cannot imagine like waking up in the middle of the night to change diapers and like have to do that again, dude. That would be brutal.
Right.
That would be brutal.
I mean, I would, if that happened to me somehow, I'd be like, how many are in there?
Yeah.
Because if it was more than one would be real rough. Yeah. But more than one, I don't know, man.
Yeah. Do you have twins in your family?
Yes, but that's not what happened with us, I don't think.
I gotcha. Yeah. All right. So before we go any further, I should have done this 50 minutes ago, but I got to send a shout out to the partners at the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. If you're looking for a badass broadhead, go check out Wasp Archery. Most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States of America. And if you put a Wasp broadhead, whether it's in the guts or double lung them, lots of damage. Great material. They can take a beating. Most of the time, if my broadheads are not like bent or something, or it's like just like a gnarly tangle up like through the shoulder and they break off, I actually can use them again. So go check out wasparchery.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Vortex Optics. Amazing company. Absolutely love the people that work there. It is still turkey season out there. So if you're looking for a badass red dot to put on your turkey shotgun, go check out vortexoptics.com. Then we have Code Blue Scents. Whether you are looking for real or synthetic deer urines, whether you're looking for scent elimination products like body washes and sprays, go check out CodeBlueScents.com. I do have a discount code there, NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Reveal Trail Cameras. These guys are doing some amazing things with the cellular technology, as well as they have upgraded their platform and their app to include mapping and being able to drop pins and all of that stuff. Go check out tacticam.com/cameras and go check out the newest camera, which is the Ultra. And then last but not least, my company, Full Sneak Gear. And Tony, this is where I have marketing hiccups, because I own a t-shirt company / apparel company that has deer on t-shirts. And you helped me actually create the Slayer t-shirt, the white or a Full Sneak Slayer t-shirt, which is badass, by the way. And so if you want to buy a t-shirt with a deer on it, go check out fullsneakgear.com. I guess, I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
The Johnson kids need some more Culvers, buddy.
I know, exactly. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And today, back by popular demand, Mr. Tony Peterson. Tony, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. It looks like you're still in the recovery phase of life, huh?
Yep, definitely still in the recovery phase. I could probably go back up to the studio office and record these episodes, but if I sit down too long, my knee just gets really tight, and I figure I'll just sit in bed and I'll prop my foot up on a pillow and just try to relax a little bit while I do these things. So, yeah.
Has this experience, like, is it a motivator for you when you get back where you can move around again to, you know, like, just try to take care of yourself as best as possible and avoid anything possible like this?
Yeah, dude, I'm telling you 100%. This has been a huge wake up call as far as like health wise. Like, I've dropped 17 pounds since my knee surgery, and I'm going to attribute that to no appetite because of the pain and muscle atrophy from just not being able to do anything. Right. And so I'll just tell you this, like, as soon as my knee is ready, I'm putting my foot on the gas as far as living my best life, but also understanding that my days of ego lifting, trying to just like, oh, I got 300 today, or I've deadlifted 400 today, like that kind of shit, it's gone. Like, that's right. There's a different version of me that has to happen. And so that old version of me is going into a cocoon, and I don't know what's going to pop up. A moth might have, I might be a moth, or I might be a butterfly, dude. I don't know.
Well, for Mark's sake, I hope you're a butterfly.
I don't even know what that means. What does that mean?
It just means he's a huge fan of butterflies, buddy.
Okay. All right. I was just like, you were trying to insult him, but you didn't really have anything prepared. And then it just came out like, well, I got to throw in a low jab on Mark, and we'll just, we'll insert it here.
But I can't think about butterflies without thinking about Mark. In my head, they're just intrinsically linked.
He has been really getting into the like environmental, like, saving the wildlife type of vibe, right? So I can see him liking all pollinators, right?
Man,
they're very important.
He's going hard on the conservation stuff right now with his new role at Meat Eater. He's doing a good job there.
Yeah. I got him scheduled for next week, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And, dude, I wonder what it's like to have, I'm just going to use like Mike Lee, for example. Okay. The dude is notorious for wanting to sell public land, right? Just, I can't imagine sitting down and having a conversation with this guy when you want one thing and he wants something completely different, and they take a meeting with you like it's going to change anything, right? Just don't have the meeting, because this Mike Lee guy's not stopping, right?
Right.
It's just, I don't know, like, they're just scumbags, dude.
You know, 100%. But it's also, you know, that situation with selling off the public land, like if you take Mike Lee as the example, right?
Right.
He's a fairly common enemy in the hunting space, right?
Right.
And his interests are in selling off that public land. It's going to make him a bunch of money on the back end for sure. Otherwise, it wouldn't be such a push, right? Yeah. You know, like you know what's going on there. But I look at that and I go, man, we've been doing that to each other in the hunting space a long time. And listen, I don't want public lands to be sold ever. Like, I think public lands are crazy important. But when you look at it and go, that guy just universally sucks for his belief that he should do this.
Mm-hmm.
I see that all the way down through the hunting ranks, where it's like, I don't care if they ban trail cameras on public land. I hunt private land. It's like, well, can you put yourself in the shoes of somebody who only hunts public land? And I mean, you know, and it's really tough, but I like seeing, you know, it's crazy that we kind of finally have a unified front, mostly in the hunting space, and this public land issue and this latest BWCA disaster up there. Yeah. It's doing something. Like, it feels like a lot of people are aware of this, and it's becoming something. So that, I mean, that part's good.
Yeah. So check this out. I mean, this has nothing to do with hunting, but it does have something to do with the landscape. In the neighboring town to the north of me, they are starting the process, or they're in the process of building these gigantic data centers. Okay. You've heard about these, right? Yep. Everybody's heard about these data centers. The city said you cannot drill a well because it's going to potentially impact the water table, because they're going to be dealing with, like, I think it's like millions of gallons of water a day to cool off or do whatever. And then that water becomes contaminated and it can't go, it can't be reused and or put back into the environment. Okay. So they got to do something with it.
Where are they supposed to get their water from then?
But just check this out. So what happens? They continue to build the buildings, and instead of, like, because in order to do that, you have to have the water. They drilled the wells anyway and paid the fine instead of, so they said no wells. They drilled the wells and they paid the fine for drilling the wells, but they still have the well. So I don't understand how that works. We said no, and then you did it anyway. And then you're like, oh, we're just a multi, you know, we're just a multi-million dollar company. We'll just pay the $10,000, $20,000 fine. That's it. You know, and now you still get a well. What the fuck, dude? That's what's happening all over this country.
Right. I mean, this is maybe a crazy tangent and maybe I'm totally wrong here, but I think that's part of the reason people are so spun up and miserable in the last, you know, mm-hmm. 5 or 10 years. It's like, we have just seen, it was so easy for us to sort of sit here and be like, well, yeah, these third world countries are all corrupt and that country is corrupt and that country's, and then you start to see how easy it is for there to be two types of justice in this country. And there's a way to get away with everything if you have enough money. And it's just so disheartening. That shit sucks so much.
Yeah. Yep. I'll just pay the fine. You know, like, dude, you hear about that shit all the time. Like, whether it's politicians and they're just like, well, I didn't know you couldn't break that rule. Well, you still broke it. Well, okay, well, I'll donate X number of dollars to, I mean, shit, you hear about some of these quote unquote poaching charges from back in the day where a guy donated X number of dollars to a certain conservation organization or back to the state conservation board, and the poaching charge just disappeared. So like, what? Now what? Right? So I don't know, man. It's really frustrating that, especially in this country, there's so much that unites us and that we're all fed up for, but it's the little things that keep us apart, and they're doing that. I just, what the fuck, dude? And it just pisses me off, man.
I'm pretty curious to see where that data center thing goes.
Oh, it's not going anywhere.
No, but I mean, in a broad scale, I'm like, where does that end up? Like, what's,
right?
Because that is such a huge push right now in so many places.
Yep. They're offering like quadruple the amount on land for land. So imagine, like, you, how many brothers and sisters do you have?
Just one sister.
You have one sister. Okay. Your dad's like this farmer and he's like, dude, don't sell my land. Don't sell my land. Whatever. You know, he dies. And some data center company comes to you and goes, I'm going to offer you $30,000 an acre for your 400 acres. Cha-ching. Where am I? Write the check, dude. What are you going to do?
Of course. Right?
That's retirement money. You just retired. You know, I mean?
If you handle that money correctly, that's generational wealth.
Exactly. And so now you have just this influence of revenue that's coming in and changing people's lives. And you would be stupid almost not to take the money. You would just have to be like, I'm okay with my life in order for that to happen. I hate you so much that I'm not going to take your money. But how's that work? Like, that's not people. Right. Most people are struggling right now. I mean, me and my wife, we make good money and it doesn't seem like we're going anywhere.
Right.
We're just treading water, it feels like.
Right.
And so I don't know, man. It's just a weird, weird time to be alive.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, and you think about, you know, that farmer, landowner, whatever. I mean, if he doesn't take that money, somebody else is going to. And, you know, I think about this. I had a conversation with a guy who owns a place I hunt here in the suburbs, and they've been selling off their family land in phases to developers for, I don't know, probably 6 years now. And I talked to him the other day, just BSing with him. And they, I mean, if you can imagine having 430 acres in the suburbs of the Twin Cities and selling that off, you're making crazy money.
Crazy money.
Right. All, every house that's going up on there is $1 million, and there's houses going up on there constantly.
Yeah.
He said the first third of it went to estate taxes. The second third went to long-term care for his parents, and they're working on the third phase now. And I think about that, and, you know, like you said, you're going to take that money. Like there's going to be a point where that money is too much, and you're like, we're going to take that. But they've had that land in the family since the 1930s, and this is, they're finally selling it off, and they're going to have not that much to show for it. Exactly. By the time it's done, it's not like all the kids are walking away millionaires and everybody's set. Right. And you just look at that and go, man, that's just like, it is like the natural cycle, but it's freaking sad to just see that go away. See all those animals are gone. Like the carrying capacity is gone. They're all houses now. And then the family that's kept that land and taken care of it for 90 some years isn't going to be like significantly better off, like as a whole. And you're like, God, what's it for then?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. This whole land thing, it's crazy, right? Cause I have this goal, like in my mind, where I want to be a landowner at some point in my life, like sooner rather than later would be nice. And I've had this conversation before. Dude, it just doesn't feel like it's going to be a reality for me. I don't know if I feel like I'm pretty frugal with my spending habits, right? Like, yeah, I'll go out and grab a coffee, or I'll take my kids to Culver's or something like that. But it's not like I have this luxurious lifestyle. Like I own my own business. You know, I'd rather own my own business than go work for somebody else. My wife makes good money. It doesn't seem like I'll ever be that one percenter that's going to be able to be a landowner. And whether that's land prices or the economy or just maybe I'm not motivated enough. I don't know what the case is. It just does not seem like a reality to me.
Well, I can tell you that it probably won't be unless you really lower your standards to get in on some land somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's people. I look at the land buying thing. I've bought three properties in my life. I only own one of them now. I sold the second one last summer, but I had to buy in places that just were not desirable, and they've become far more desirable over, you know, the last 10 years. But I talk to people all the time, especially our age, where you start to like face that reality where you're like, man, I'm never going to be able to just buy like 200 acres of killer ground in Iowa, right? Like it's just never going to happen. And you sort of face that, but you're like, okay, well, I don't really want to go buy land that's half swamp somewhere 5 hours from my house, but almost any land that you can get your hands on, if you can sit on it a while, is going to be that next step up, like give you that down payment for the next one. But it's a bitch, man. Like, you know, that's one category where, you know, unless we get another housing market crash or something, which we will at some point, you're not going to get any kind of remote or even like a remotely good deal on ground.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know, man. It's just like, okay, well, let's say I do have the money for the down payment. Now I have to have X number of dollars a month additional for the expense of that land as well. So it's just like, all right, what's going to change? Maybe I just need to, like we've talked about in the past, that OnlyFans option, man, right?
Only Dan's.
I wonder if that, onlydans.com. I wonder if that's a thing.
And a bunch of dudes named Dan
Taking feet pictures with medium penises and just like, you know, like dad bods.
Dude, You know there's a market for it. It might not be land buying money.
No. No, but just some gas money. Well, if I can make gas money, dude, then it's that's
you might be able to do Culver's 3 days a week with the kids, buddy.
Best dad ever. Exactly. Oh, that's funny. We got this guy in Iowa right now. He's running for governor, and he thinks that, like, he does not like the idea of outside investors owning land in the state of Iowa. He also is not a, and that I think might even trickle over to non-resident landowners. He feels that Iowa land should be held by Iowa residents, landowners, get back to like working the land, that kind of thing. What are your thoughts on comments like that?
I hate it. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because what he's doing is he's taking, and I'm just filling in here. I just got this information from you, so I could be totally wrong. But what he's doing is, so we've gotten these news stories about like Chinese investors buying farmland, right?
Yep.
A lot of farmland in the Midwest. I think universally we can look at that as people and go, I don't think that doesn't sound like a great idea. We have 340 million people in this country. We can't find people who live here to buy that land.
Yeah.
But at the same time, using that as like scaling it way down and being like, okay, some dude in Nebraska can't buy 40 acres of land in Western Iowa and go over there and hunt with his kids. Like, are you against that too? Mm-hmm. And that, I don't like that. Like you know how I feel about the resident, non-resident thing. I think we're reaping what we've sown on that, and it sucks.
Yeah.
When you look how hard it is to go get a turkey tag in another state now and how quickly that happened. It's like our kids, the opportunities for our kids are almost gone. And we did that to ourselves as hunters. And I just don't like it.
Who did that?
Like we did
what,
it.
What I know we did it, but what group of hunters did that? Like, is it the public land? The
residents of Colorado, Idaho, Wyoming, South Dakota, you name it. And it trickled on over to us.
That's so you're saying that the resident, like I had this conversation hunters. Last week, resident hunters are taking the power back and they're saying, we don't want any non-resident hunters coming back.
I don't think they're taking the power back. I think they're just wielding power that they didn't realize they had until another state showed them that they did.
Yeah.
And I think look, I get it, right? Like I understand their argument, but when you do that, those opportunities never come back. And I've said this a billion times and I'm sick of saying it, but you know, like when I talk to Clay at work, like Clay Newcomb is huge into bears, right? And his focus a lot of times, like his is on anti-hunters because bears, mountain lions, you know, those critters are a big target for anti-hunting efforts.
Right.
And so his concern is losing hunting opportunities to a very identifiable enemy of hunters.
Yeah.
And then I look at it and go, I've lost way more opportunities to resident hunters saying that, you know, the game is held in the trust for the people of the state and we can do what we want with it.
Yeah.
Like, and the thing about this is, so I've fished Montana. I fished Florida. I just bought an Iowa fishing license. I just bought a South Dakota fishing license. When you just look at the process for buying a license now. So Florida, I'll just give you an example. Florida is very non-resident friendly compared to a lot of states, right?
Yeah.
Florida wants to sell you a fishing license because they have 70 million people a year who fly into Orlando and a certain percentage of them are going to buy licenses or whatever. Big destination for fishing.
Yep.
Well, it used to be you could buy a 3 or a 7 day license as a non-resident because most people are coming in for a short trip and that was that. Well, this year I go to buy and you can't buy the 3 or the 7 day license online, but they will sell you an annual license online. And so it's like, okay, so you're just taking advantage of the fact that, you know, I'm flying in and you can sell me this more expensive tag than or force me to go through the hassle of having to buy a different license on site in state, which is insane because if you can sell me the annual license online, you can sell me the temporary license online, but they don't. And then when you go to check out, there's 8 different things that are like, buy this, you know, Fish and Wildlife Yeti, buy this, donate for this, do this. And it's this like death by microtransaction thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think that's the thing that's wearing people out too, is like, we are so exposed to how often we just kind of get taken advantage of and we don't have a choice over it.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Dude. So people are bitching that other hunters are coming into their spots, and now the, you know, Colorado, Wyoming, Iowa, now Missouri is going to start doing something like that. You know, trying to make it a draw, for non-residents. Does this mean that there's too many hunters on the landscape right now?
I don't think so. I mean, when you look at the numbers, I mean, maybe I'm too close to this. It is so hard for this, for me to see this not just as a very easy money grab for them. You know, they can make the residents happy and they can tighten up the tags, but it's generally, I shouldn't say this. If you're talking Midwest and East, where you're talking whitetails and turkeys,
yeah,
you're generally not talking about a resource issue, right? Like, they're not like, we're going to kick non-residents out because we're killing too many deer or turkeys. Out West is a different story. When you're talking about elk, when you're talking about pronghorn, mule deer, there is a case to be made, right, for the resource, which is fine. Like, that's great. But they need to make that case, and they're generally not. And when you see it in, you know, like Missouri, when you look at Missouri, what they did with their turkey tags this year, I mean, is it tied to the fact that, or is it tied to the turkey population? Okay, so you take away some opportunities, or you increase the price to $305 for a turkey tag for non-residents.
Yeah.
A resident can pay $20 and kill 2 turkeys. Like, who's impacting that resource? So the lowest hanging fruit is the non-resident, but eventually, you know, like, I would guess that the Venn diagram of hunters who bitch about hunting becoming a rich man's sport and hunters who would also advocate for keeping non-residents out is damn near a complete circle. But if you're an advocate for this, you're making it a rich man's sport. Who's paying $305 for a turkey tag?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
When you look at an elk tag now, anywhere for a non-resident is $1,000 plus.
Yeah.
Like, so you know what I mean? It's like a short-sighted thing. And it's we have unleashed this thing, and now we're going to be dealing with it for a long time. And I just think it's short-sighted.
Yeah. I said a couple weeks ago, I felt like the hunting is almost like a bubble right now, that it just seems like everybody is complaining about everything. Right. You know, whether it's the weapon of choice, whether it is the resident, non-resident, whether it's public, private, all that stuff. And it's going to pop, and things will settle down after a while, almost like the stock market, right? Like that, like you said, a housing crash. Right. Is that something that is needed? Like, and I guess if I back up a second, how entwined is the hunting community in with the hunting industry? You know what I mean? Like, COVID did something. You know what I mean? COVID did something that made the hunting industry grow.
So, well, for sure. I mean, people had money and time,
yeah.
You know, and they just really wanted to get outside, because a lot of things people could do, they couldn't do then, right? Or would want to do, they couldn't do then. Man, I don't think the general hunting population understands the hunting industry at all. Like, I don't think, I mean, I say this partially because I watched somebody like Matt Ranella and his message about too many people out there and R3 sucks and whatever. And he blames it primarily on people like me and you and his brother. And I'm like, you don't even understand how the hunting industry works. Like, you have no idea how much money is put into this stuff and how this whole thing functions with PR and marketing and research and development, and what this money is and being used for, and how the narratives are like crafted, you know, like how all of a sudden it's like everybody has to have a saddle. Well, part of the reason is because, you know, there's a new wave of saddle hunters and a new wave of companies come out and they're making this product. And it's a coordinated effort to promote this thing and make this seem like this is the answer to your problem. And that happens over and over and over again in the hunting industry. And it's a cycle to extract money out of people on the promise that we're going to make hunting easier for you.
Yeah.
And there are so many people involved in it, from the companies that manufacture, like I said, through the marketing companies, through these PR companies, on down to big time influencers, little influencers, whatever. And there's so, you've seen it. I mean, you see it all the time. There's so much to that that the average person doesn't know. And it's easy to be like, well, Lee and Tiffany suck. They sold out. And I'm like, you just have no idea what's between them and the other side of this thing.
Yeah. So how does that then connect to the average hunter's experience? And what I mean by that is everybody's like, the residents are saying, dude, slow down on this non-resident stuff. Our experience are not the same as they used to be. So we have to find somebody to blame. Let's blame non-residents right now. Right. So it's the experience is what are pissing people off, whether it's access, whether it's the size of big bucks that are no longer there, or too many hunters at their favorite spots. Like, how is all that connected?
So that's not experience. That is the perception of experience. So there is a big difference, right? It's easy for people to be like, there are too many people out there. But let me ask you this. Have you ever talked to a hunter who's like, you know what? I'm actually pretty lazy. I don't like to put in work and scout. I don't like to put in effort. I like to go out for the 3 days a year that I like to hunt to the place that's down the road from my house.
Yeah.
And now that sucks. So the reason I say that is because it's not entirely the perception, right? If you take a trailhead out in Colorado and you show up there and you've been hunting there 20 years and there's 50 trucks and horse trailers and all that stuff, that's not like a make-believe thing. That's real, right? Like you can see that ramping up, whether it's all hunters or not, who knows? But how often do you hear somebody be like, there are no big bucks on public land here, or you can't even find a deer here, or it's not worth pheasant hunting here anymore, and on down the line. Like, I'll give you an example. I just got home last night. I was over in Wisconsin, just roaming public land, looking for some places to hunt turkeys, looking for some places to hunt deer on properties I'd never been to. And I found tons of good shit.
Yeah.
And it's turkey season, so I was pretty sensitive to, if there's a truck parked anywhere, I'm not going in there. There wasn't hardly anybody out on a beautiful weekend in turkey season. And I promise you that I can go out and find people in those areas who will be like, there is no reason to go hunt public land because it's packed. And I go, how could that be? Like, how could this be? How can the hunting public guys show up in your backyard and kill a big buck on public land when you're sitting there telling me they're not there anymore? And so a lot of this is a perception, and it's easy look at how we started talking about the data centers.
Yeah.
And the money that's going into that, right? There is like an anti-capitalism vibe in the country right now, right? And totally justified in some ways. And yet every one of us is using lots and lots of data every day. Every one of us is, not every one of us, a lot of us are using AI for something, but it's easy for us to disconnect our culpability in any of this and be like, well, those assholes are bad because they want to make money. And it's like, well, you're using their product. You know, like you're using resources all the time, and it's just so easy for us to sort of not take any accountability. And when you think about the average hunter, and I don't mean somebody who listens to this podcast or like who is actively trying to get better at hunting and learn how to do things, like I'm talking the average, which is, you know, in somebody like here in Minnesota, this was a long time ago and maybe it's changed, but they did a little study on hunter hours that are put in or effort. And the average bow hunter they hunted parts of, I think, 11 days of the entire season. And the average gun hunter hunted parts of 3 days.
Yeah.
For their entire year. So when you and I talk and the people listen to this, we're not talking to those people. and they represent the majority of us. And so it's hard for us because we're in this space where we're talking to people who care about this. Like, this is part of their identity, and like they really live this shit to an extent that the average person doesn't. And we forget about that a lot of times because we're in this like sort of echo chamber. But the reality is most hunters don't really want to put in any work. They don't want to put themselves out. They go out there because they always have, and they want to go to the same stand or the same spot or whatever. And it's like, it just doesn't give you a lot of success doing that.
Yeah. What about the people who are involved and are connected, whether that's to the land or to the data, like, or the statistics and that the specific states put out? Like, I'll tell you this, there's less turkeys out right now alive. I don't care how much I scout. I'll tell you this right now. There's less turkeys out there right now in the state of Iowa than there has been 7 years ago. Okay. On the farms that I've hunted, there are less mature bucks. And that's kind of like a, oh, poor me, you know, there's less big bucks. There's less 150s out there than there has been over the last 5 years. And so when people, what would your advice be to somebody who says there's less turkeys out there? There's less, this farm used to carry X number of deer. Now it carries way less, and the age class is way down, right? Like, there's outside motivators that are contributing to that guys like me don't get to control.
So I would say the turkey thing is way more interesting to me right now because that is true. Yeah. There is a big swath of this country where we had, when you go back to like 2014, 2015, we had crazy amounts of turkeys in a lot of states. Uh-huh. And we don't anymore. And I know there are states looking into this. I know Kansas is studying this. This is a thing. We don't know why yet. Like, we don't know why the turkey populations have come down that way. So to me, I look at that, I go, I don't think that that's an anecdotal observation on your part, because multiple states are going, where'd they go? What happened to them? Was it avian flu? What is it? So that's a resource issue. So I look at that and I go, that is something where I'm like, okay, if they're going to pare down tags and go, we have a 3 or 5 year plan on this to see where it goes and try to get these birds back and study this. Great. Like, that's science. Like, that makes sense to me. When you say there are fewer 150s on the landscape, I don't know what that means. Like, I don't know what you're saying with that. Like, are you inferring that more people are killing younger ones, or they're killing too many bucks, or what do you think's going on there?
Yeah, well, I look at it as, and this is very hyper focused on the state of Iowa.
Sure.
Right. So obviously it's been out of the bag. You know, Iowa is the number one destination. People want to come to Iowa. People want to lease land in Iowa. People want to own land in Iowa. And if they have the means, they make it happen. Right. And so what you're finding, and this is in my opinion, we have all these 100 acres here, 40, 50 acres here that are getting leased and sold. And people are coming in and everybody wants a booner, right? Well, you're not going to eat your tag. You're not going to have trigger control for 3 or 4 years and wait for a booner when there's no booners around. So how long are you willing to eat your tag until you start licking your lips at that 140, at that 145? You know what I mean? And that's a trigger control thing.
But why shouldn't people be able to shoot 140s and 145s?
That's what I'm saying. I don't have a problem with that. What I'm saying is that's what people are bitching about right now. And that is what is a potential motivator. And this is not just in the state of Iowa. But this is where I've been kind of paying attention to the state of Michigan, mm-hmm. where there's a large group of people out there who are wanting to basically restructure the way that deer tags are allocated in the state of Michigan right now, right? They want to go to a one buck state. They want to change a lot of when maybe even the rifle season opens up and things like that. And so there's a group of people who are saying the opposite of that. They want older age class. They want bigger antlered deer. They want those opportunities. Meanwhile, this is the devil's advocate part of me is going, what gives you the right to do that when there's another group of people who are completely happy with doing what has always been done right there, whether right. that's baiting or whether that's shooting 2 4-corns every single year.
So what you're talking about here is a, is the duality. Well, I guess that maybe that's not the right word. You have
the matrix.
You have state game agencies where their funding is primarily from license sales.
Yep.
So they have a vested interest in a lot of people buying licenses and that money coming in. And then you have, it's, I would say it's probably skewed more toward the world we live in. And so we hear from this maybe in a sort of a biased way, but it does seem like a lot of people want to manage for older age class and trophy deer in our world. But that does not jive with selling 100 or 200 or 400,000 deer tags a year. And right. so that's what we're dealing with. So you can say, well, we don't have these deer anymore and we have to do something on this front. And, you know, like I follow the Michigan thing too with the 2-buck thing. And I'm just not like, I'm not that close to Michigan. Like I don't,
yeah,
it's not like an issue. I understand why they're fired up and I like to weigh in on it. It's just not my place. Yeah. But I look at like your example in Iowa and I go, I drew my first Iowa tag in 2009. And in the space between that tag and the one that I drew in 2013, corn prices got really high, really high. And when I went back, I hunted the same farm in 09, 2013, and I didn't even recognize some parts of it because all of the trees were gone.
Yep.
And I was like, I asked my buddy who lives down there. I'm like, holy shit, wasn't there like a big draw with woods here? He's like, yeah, it's all gone and tiled out. When you have a phase of land use like that, down the road, you're going to have a diminished carrying capacity for those animals. So if you want a lot of 150s, you need a lot of places for bucks to live and grow old. When you take out X amount of those places, you'll have fewer 150s. And I'm not saying this isn't tied to, you know, people killing too many 100-inchers or whatever, but I'm saying like most of the time when we have issues like this, we want to look at it as a very black and white, like here's the fix, here's the problem, here's the fix.
Yeah.
But you're dealing with dynamic populations of wild animals.
Yep.
Right. And so when you talk about generally, if you want to have those good deer, you know, I mean, you could do antler point restrictions. You could do some stuff and definitely promote older deer. You could cut Iowa residents down to one tag and put some more value on that buck tag. There's things you could do. You could cut the non-resident tags, even though they're not giving out tons. I mean, that's pretty regulated, but you could do it.
Yep.
But if you don't take into account that other stuff, I feel like you're sort of chasing your tail a lot of times with these issues.
Yeah. It just becomes tough because one person can feel very heated about their own experience. And I'll just say for me, over the course of my 30 years of hunting, the biggest access issue that I have had, you know, yes, don't get me wrong, I could go hunt public land, but the county that I grew up in, I think had 100 acres of public land, maybe a little more. But not a lot. The county that I live in now, there's way more than that. But there are counties in Iowa that don't have public land. In some of those counties, you have these non-residents who, you know, like somebody come the farmer dies, the kids sell the farm, who buys it? Non-resident for deer hunting. Those people are now displaced. So for them, that is the biggest issue is non-residents coming in and buying property, you know, displacing. I don't want to say kicking them out, but displacing them because a resident could have bought that ground too and kicked them out. But so for a guy like me, if I was going to bitch about something, it would be the non-resident coming in and stealing, or not stealing, that's the wrong word, buying the land and then displacing the hunter And now those, all those people have to go somewhere else. And that happens, that has happened a lot for me. So I would be like, if I was going to bitch about that, I would be like, well, that's the number one issue. That's the biggest issue, whether I have the data for that or not. You know what I mean?
I mean, to that, I would counter and I'd say, how much land do you have? How much private land do you have to hunt?
Yeah.
How much do you have?
Oh, I have. I have 600 acres. I would say that 620 acres. And I would say of that, maybe 180 of it is not ag. So 180 acres of like timbers and fingers and things like that. Deer habitat.
Yeah. How many other people hunt it?
The one farm, quite a bit. I would say there's three other bow hunters. There's one old timer who's a muzzleloader hunter. And then there are shotgun hunters that drive it, both first and second. The other farm that I have, I'm the only person who is allowed to hunt it.
Would you consider sharing that with some of the residents who lost their spots to non-residents buying land?
I potentially would, maybe like a shotgun season or a muzzleloader season, you know? And so that's where that experience comes in, right? And that's where people have got to. I feel like I would. I feel like I would. And here's why, Tony. Because I know what it's like to lose ground. And my mindset about big antlers has changed over the course of, like, I understand that hunting is not all about antlers, right? And the buck I shot this year kind of just solidifies that. Like, I wanted something. I wanted that buck. I chased a couple big deer throughout the course of the season, and I was like, you know what? This buck makes me happy at this time. And so I feel that hunting is more than antlers. It's more than age class. It's more than, it means something different to me now than what it did 5-10 years ago. And so I don't think I would be too opposed to bringing in other people, right? I have kids that hunt with me now. And so I'm bringing them in. And if they're, I'm not going to turn them down. I'm not going to say no to them shooting 100-inch 2-year-old, right?
Right.
And so, like, I'm kind of past that point in my life, dude.
I am too. But a lot of people aren't.
Yeah, and I get it.
I mean, that's the trophy hunting thing is a real bitch.
It
always has been for us, because that is that mindset, and this whole style of growing deer and naming them, and you know, the thing we see a lot on a lot, you know, the Outdoor Channel or whatever.
Yep.
I mean, that is, it's like sort of a symptom of a disease, right? Like if you're going to gatekeep ground if you can a lot of times, right? And so when people lose ground, like, I mean, I've lost tons of spots, right? I'm losing one to development right now. I've lost lots of them being sold. I've lost them because other people were shitty, like right on down the line.
Yeah.
But we also have a hard time sharing a lot of times, right? Because it's like, I want, you know, we can say that we don't want that big buck or whatever, but we're also not just opening the doors to anyone, right? Like, so we are all a part of this problem. And it's like, you know, you brought this up several times, like we are looking for someone to blame. And it's easy to blame some dude who lives across state lines in Missouri or Nebraska or whatever. It's very hard to blame that family, you know, that farming family that we like and we grew up with, who goes out shotgun hunting and fills every tag they can on the end of a drive every year. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But that's all a part of this thing. And it's just tough. And
do you think that people should care more or kind of care less?
About what? Trophies?
No, about the outcome. About what their goals are every year. Like, let's say you got a guy who, dude, my goal is a 154-year-old every single year, whatever, you know, or you enter in the state and the age class and the whatever you know, maybe in Indiana that's different or Michigan that's different. You enter that number in. There's a lot of people that care about that. And then there's also a lot of people that don't care about it. And they do their 3 days of hunting, like you mentioned. They fill their freezers with, you know, the deer sticks and things like that. And they're happy with that. Like, should people should we just care a little less and get out there and just enjoy hunting?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. Like, I firmly believe that. And I mean, I'm in a weird spot with big bucks and stuff like that. Cause I like to hunt them. They're super fun. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't really matter. You know, like you can go out and have a good year and kill three big bucks. And it's like, who does that affect? Like, what does it really matter? And so, yeah, I think that we should have more fun. Like, I think we should be pushing that message. Like, I think we should be banging that drum everywhere. You know, like, if you want to go squirrel hunt your deer ground, go squirrel hunt it. Like, who cares? Yeah. You know, like, it's not that special to kill a big buck anymore. You know, like, there are so many big deer that are being killed, and we kind of figured out how to do it. And like, I know that's entirely situational and it's really difficult, but that is one of the reasons why I still love hunting public land and going out and finding new spots, because I feel like it's sort of a contrarian move where people say you can't, but you can. And you go out and you just have a different set of standards, you know, like I'm not going to go that public land. I was scouting in Wisconsin. I would never start the season and be like, I'm only going to shoot a 130 plus or whatever, because I don't even know what I'm getting into. Like, the adventure is just figuring that part out, you know?
Right.
And I think we've made hunting not very fun. And I think part of that is because trail cameras have become so ubiquitous across the whole thing. And there's a ton of marketing money behind trail cameras, and look, they're fun. They're great. Mm-hmm. But we've sort of sold this style of hunting where it's like, build your hit list, stay out, watch the forecast. Don't let anybody in there. Let those deer get real comfortable and then go in and surgically strike them. And most of the strategy is not going into the woods ever until you believe you can kill. And I'm just like, man, we're supposed to be in the woods. You know, like, I always think about that. Like, if somebody was like, oh, I was going to go bass fishing today, but, you know, I'm not going to catch a 5-pounder, so I'm not going to go. I'm like, who would do that? Everybody would go, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but we do that with deer all the time.
Right.
And that trickles down. And I think that's just like a dangerous, like, false read of what this thing can be.
Right. Right. Yeah. I feel you, man. It's just, I don't know, man. I need to care less. I think I honestly think I need to just care less, because I find myself saying I need to care less, but then really caring about the rules and regulations of, you know, of something that may or may not impact me.
Right.
Right. Or some neighbor, or saying one thing and doing something else, or, you know, oh my God, another person's on this farm. Like, holy shit. You know, these deer don't stand a chance, blah, 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 blah. Enter in. I find myself being a hypocrite more often. I find myself bitching about, the cares of others when I should be supporting, them and just going out and having fun. And I tell you what, it just really sucks when, and I don't know why this is, but I always feel like it should be like back in the day, right? It should be like every rut should be the best rut I've ever had. And every deer season should be, you know, like, dude, remember 2011 when I had 7 Boone and Crockett's on this farm and they were all over the place, and they were snort wheezing and I saw them and I had chances at them and I, you know, all this stuff. And it's not like that. And when it's not like that, then I get pissed and I'm just like, what's going on? What can I blame?
That is probably the biggest hurdle most hunters should try to get over, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hunting on memories. And like, you want to talk about what keeps you from growing and keeps you from just accepting that things are going to change, whether you condone them or not. It's that mindset. And we all do that, right? Like, we all do that. We look at, I mean, just bring up the topic of drones and hunting right now.
Yeah.
It instantly pisses off most people and sends you back to the time when we didn't have drones, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what we want. But that's just not how this shit works. And I think about that, like that point that you just made all the time, because that is the thing that we all deal with, right? Like,
yeah,
I, you know, here in Minnesota, we have a lot of wolves, right? Wolves get blamed for more stuff than they should, but we have a lot of wolves and they do impact the deer and a lot of big game species for sure. Right. But I'll talk to people who are like, you know, we used to go up to the cabin and we had deer around and now the wolves moved in and we don't.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, well, what are you going to do about that? Do you ever go up there and scout and try to find the places those deer go where the wolves don't? Because they have those spots, yeah. But they don't. And it's like you've kind of just made this decision like, okay, well, it's not the way it was. I'm not going to do anything about that other than complain. And it's like we all do it and it's fun and it's easy. But it just doesn't really, like, individually, it doesn't get you anywhere. Like, you just have to accept that these things change and that you have to work with them and try to figure something out. And that's, I mean, that's part of, that mentality is part of the reason why it's so appealing to get your hands on some ground, put in that food plot, keep everybody out, and every year you can show up and get into that box blind and those deer are going to show up. It's consistent. Yeah. You know, like, you don't have to, you're not solving for any problems anymore. You're like, I figured it out. But most people don't have that and they don't know how to get past that and keep working on solving those problems. So like that point that you brought up there, like I think that every one of us should sit there often and sort of be self-aware of that and understand that we're doing that because we all do that.
Yeah. Amen. I like that.
I got you. Cool. Well, there's no really way to end this, so we'll just kind of say goodbye, everybody. If you like the Nine Finger Chronicles, go to Spotify or iTunes and give me a 5-star review. Make sure you share this. And Tony, man, I always appreciate you and your time to come on and talk about a whole bunch of different things. And well, I hope you have a good rest of your day, buddy.
That's about it, right, buddy? Well, I appreciate you having me on, man.